We're live, guys. Are you ready? Welcome to Bible Quest, the Wednesday edition. And we're just having a good time with all three of these fellows before we get started. So I'm just going to turn it right over to Chase. Is that whom I'm turning it over to?
Sure, I'll take it. Hey, guys. Good to have you on today. We're going to be picking up in the book of James, as we've been doing the last couple of weeks. But today on the air, we have the full complement. We've got Jeff Smelser in Exton, Pennsylvania. Jeff, how are you today?
Good. Good afternoon. Hey, why did you take the lead here today? I'm supposed to do that.
Oh, man. Well, that might be a good segue into some things that we can talk about in the book of James today.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, we've got Joe and Elmira. How are you doing today, Joe?
Listen, if people don't get anything out of today's podcast, at least they will appreciate the fact that we have coordinated with our shirts.
That's a good
wow.
point.
All right, I'm glad.
Yeah, your shirt underneath.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Hey, guys, I don't remember where we're at. Do you guys remember?
You know, I don't know that we've gone through the book of James in such a way that we've covered everything and that we won't backtrack a little bit. But in fact, I think we will backtrack a little bit. But I think we were going to pick up with chapter 3, verse 13.
Correct. Yep.
All right. Well, let's jump in, Chase.
Oh, okay. So I am leading today. So, all right. So chapter 3, verse 13. Why don't we just go ahead and read it through the end of the chapter? Who among you is wise and understanding? By his good conduct, he should show that his works are done in the gentleness that comes from wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't boast and deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there is disorder in every evil practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peace-loving, gentle, compliant, full of mercy, good fruits, unwavering, without pretense. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who cultivate peace. So the text begins with this sound. I've heard people refer to it as a rhetorical question, but you can just imagine people being in the room whenever James asks this question: who among you is wise and understanding? Like, who in this group would consider themselves wise and understanding? You just think about the people, me, kind of like, you know, Jeff earlier, I made the joke. He's like, oh, I want to take it over. But of course, James, as he so practically has been doing, he turns around and says, well, don't just say you're wise and understanding. You got to prove it. It kind of gets back to the theme we've been looking at, right, guys, about being not just hearers of the word, but doers of the word. It's not always about what you're hearing and what you're saying. It's more about what you're doing.
You know, if you think back to the chapter 2, when he talks about showing favoritism to the rich man and less so to the poor man and so on the one hand, it's easy to say, well, they're exalting the rich, but what they're really doing is self-serving. You do that because you think that you can benefit in some way. And so there's a lot of selfishness, a self-centered attitude that's being addressed here. And when you get into this section that you just read, where it talks about this earthly wisdom that is sensual and devilish, and there's jealousy and there are factions, and it's the opposite of peaceable and gentle and easy to be entreated, it seems that James is indeed addressing some characteristics, some personality traits, some character traits that need correcting, that are selfish, self-centered.
Well, and when you just think about the world and its dealings and how it handles people, right now, guys, on Wednesday nights here at church, I'm teaching a conflict resolution class, Blessed Are the Peacemakers, and this is actually one of the texts we're going to take a look at, because the world has its own way of dealing with things and solving problems. And if we're not careful, we begin to let the world's wisdom shape the way we treat each other and the way that we make decisions. One thing that stands out to me kind of on that note, we talked about this in our class last Wednesday night. You commonly hear people say, well, if they have a problem with me, then what? They should just come to me and talk about that. Now it's normally said in the context of, oh, they're talking behind my back. They should just be willing to come to me. But in Matthew 5 on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus will say, if your brother, has something against you, you go and be reconciled to him. It's actually the opposite. The wisdom of God's word would say that we go to that person if we find out that someone has a problem with us. Whereas this earthly wisdom, it's kind of selfish and it's prideful, and it has this bitter envy that it talks about in verse 14, and it boasts and it denies the truth. God's wisdom that comes from above is able to give us the fruit of righteousness, and if it's sown in peace, it'll be by those who cultivate peace. So that's where my mind goes with this section. It's just kind of on some conflict resolution stuff.
Yeah. So Jeff, you mentioned at the beginning or early on there that, you know, we would be going back. It's almost as if we're not going back, but rather that we are simply continuing, right? Yeah. The book began with what instructions, for example, in verse 5, if anyone of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, James 1, verse 5. So the question of wisdom has been from the beginning of this book. And then, as you've mentioned, the idea of conduct or the way that we are behaving, that's in, you know, being doers of the word, treating people without partiality, controlling our tongue. You know, we're really sort of, this is almost a therefore statement in James 3, 13 and following, because this is really, in many ways, a summation. And he uses that word in verse 13, let him show by good conduct. And we've come across that word already, back in chapter 2. Now I've lost the verse there. Oh, verse 18. But someone will say, I have faith. Someone will say, you have faith, I have works. Show me your faith without your works. You know, our faith, our wisdom is demonstrated in what we do, or the lack thereof is demonstrated in what we do.
When we go from this paragraph in chapter 3 into chapter 4, again, Joe, you made the point recently, ignore verses and chapters. They're not always divided where they should be. I think there is a flow that takes us right into chapter 4. This is the American Standard, so it's worded in kind of an older style of English. Whence come wars and whence come fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your pleasures that war in your members? So the question that often gets asked is, and I'd like for us to discuss it, is he talking literally or figuratively about wars and fightings here?
I think so. I think he is talking about some, do you mean like an actual war? Like you do mean that literally, don't you?
That's what I said. Is he talking literally or figuratively?
I do think there are some tensions that you guys have already addressed, and it is as if they are warring with each other. But you're asking, are they like actually shooting and murdering? Or I guess,
well, probably not shooting firearms with gunpowder. But verse 2, you lust and have not, you kill and covet and cannot obtain, you fight and war, you have not, because you ask not. So again, the same question, literal or figurative?
I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
No, go ahead. I just thought it was funny. I said, that's is it this or that? You said, I think so.
I agree with Chase. I think it's one or the other as well.
It is. It's either this or that.
So I think he's speaking not in like what the way that we would use the word war, or my marginal reference says battle. But he does mention that there is war in your members at the end of verse 1. And so there is this conflict that is going on. I think it's between various members of the congregation there. That's the way that I would take it. Although I can easily see it applying in other ways also.
And so then what would you say about the phrase in verse 2, you kill? How would you understand that?
Maybe jumping over to chapter 5 and verse 6. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. I almost get the impression there that that's not literally murder, or else why would you have to say he does not resist you? Obviously, somebody who's murdered isn't going to resist. And maybe that's different in different translations there. I don't know.
Okay, so let me ask this. I believe in chapter 5, verse 6, you've condemned, you've killed the righteous. that is singular, not plural. And I wonder if the reference isn't to Jesus. Let me just take a look at that real quickly here.
While he's doing that,
It is singular. It's the righteous one.
Yeah. But are these people, so he's saying, and I think that then fitting then for it to be the Lord, are they, is he saying you're guilty of killing Jesus, or that they have rejected Jesus and he's not resisting them? I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too far ahead with that.
So don't take what I say here as a studied, like, don't say, oh, wow, he must know something. I'm throwing this out there as an unprepared thought and unconsidered question. So you may come right back with it. Well, that can't be because of this. And I go, oh, okay. But we've talked about the audience to which James is writing. We've talked about how strongly Jewish letter this is. We've talked about the fact that Jesus is mentioned a couple of times, chapter 2, verse 1, my brethren, hold not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect to persons. So he is writing to Christians. And yet we've also, I think, called attention to the fact that it seems James does at times turn his attention to maybe all Jews. And could it be that in turning his attention to all Jews, that when he says something like chapter 4, verse 1 and 2, whence come wars and whence come fightings among you? You lust and have not, you kill. Verse 3, your gold and your chapter 5, verse 3, or verse 1 even, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and your silver are rusted. That James actually turns his attention not just to the Christians who are recipients of his letter, but to Jews in general.
Yeah, I think that may be. I will touch back on that James 5 for just a moment. So in the context, I don't see that just one. And I recognize, I just, while we were talking about that, I looked, New American Standard has the righteous man, ESV, the righteous person. I'm seeing that righteous man, a righteous person, as being the laborer of verse 4, that they are mistreating there. And so you have this just person that they are putting, that they are murdering or putting to death. I don't think literally. I think he's saying that they are silencing him. But I would think that that goes along, even chapter 4 and verse 11, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. And so this idea of wars and fighting against each other, they're trying to silence each other. They're trying to, you know, climb over top of each other, kind of the Galatians 5 image of biting and devouring one another. Mm-hmm. Such carnality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So can I suggest another possible theme here in these verses? No, not at all.
Yes, you may.
I'll tell you another one that stands out to me is pride and humility. I would say that those are kind of the tensions being addressed as well, starting in the section we began in chapter 3, as he talks about who among you is wise and understanding, you need to show by the gentleness that comes from wisdom, opposed to this other guy who has bitter envy and selfish ambition. That's what's driving him, pride. I realize those two words, humility and pride, are not used there. But then they are used when you turn around in chapter 4 and he describes these people who are waging and warring and murdering and coveting. And he turns it around in chapter 4 and verse 6 and he says, God gives greater grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud and he gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God. So there's a call here on the prideful and the arrogant in the group to humble themselves before God humbles them.
Yeah, I think that's a nice take on that. I like that.
So going back to the first part of chapter 4, he moves on after talking about their lusting and they're really materialistic in their aims and that's the source of their problems. And he says in verse 4, you adulteresses, and I think the King James and I think the New King James as well will say you adulterers and adulteresses. I should check that.
Do either of you? It does, but it has a marginal reference that omits it.
Okay. It seems that the evidence is that James just wrote you adulteresses, but you can see why a scribe would think, well, I should add adulterers here, because surely James is not just rebuking the women. He's rebuking the men also. But in doing that, there's a failure to understand the Old Testament imagery here. How often in the Old Testament do we see God's people portrayed as God's wife, and that they are guilty of adultery when they go and worship other gods, spiritual adultery? They're not faithful to their God. And so whether male or female in Israel, when they worshiped idols, they were adulteresses. And that's the language James is using here. Would have been very familiar to a Jewish audience.
Yeah, and it goes along with things that Paul has taught in other places as well. I think it fits the context here. James 4:7 talks about submitting to God. And so you have that bride submission as well. Yeah, I think that's a very excellent point. Maybe even the idea of verse 5 amplifies that a bit, with the spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously. You know, that relationship that we ought to have with God.
Going back to what we were talking about a moment ago, we have a comment from Jane who says, talking about the killing and the wars, is the better word than kill and wars, et cetera, perhaps disparaged? That is, what you hold of value is nothing. And I think what she's getting at is the figurative idea that the wars in view in James 4:1, she's looking at that and the killing as just the figuratively, which is what you two were both saying. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted your thought, Joe.
No, that's all. I was just amening your thought there, that we need to see ourselves as the bride of Christ. This is another one of those passages like Ephesians 5 that even draws the same conclusion. Ephesians 5 talks about how the bride is to submit, and he makes that same statement here in 4:7.
So there's a theme in the Old Testament. There's this idea that we see repeatedly: I am holy, you shall be holy. I will be your God, you will be my people. If I'm going to be your God and you're going to be my people, well, I'm holy, so you're going to have to be holy. And that's the same mentality that we are supposed to see when we see ourselves as part of the church, which is the bride of Christ, which he has made by his blood, by his sacrifice, holy and without blemish. And yet you mentioned Ephesians 5. At the beginning of Ephesians 4, Paul says, walk worthily of your calling. So this is our calling, to be the bride of Christ, holy and without blemish. In the beginning of Ephesians, he says he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blemish. So if we're going to be God's people, then Peter says in 1 Peter, the first chapter, he quotes that language from, I think it's from Leviticus, you shall be holy for I am holy. And so that's the idea here when we think of ourselves as the bride of Christ.
So. Going with that, the phrase that jumps off to me is in verse 8, where he says, draw near to God, he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded.
Yeah.
This is something he's brought up back in chapter 1. He talked about this double-mindedness. But the walk with God cannot be defined by someone halfway in and halfway out. And that's what these people, it sounds like, are being tempted to do, or are doing, is they have some friendship with the world, and then they're trying to have friendship with God. And James is trying to reset them and say, it doesn't work that way. It's being double-minded, and you will be judged for that.
How would you like to marry a woman who is half into the marriage and half not? She's, yeah, I love you, and I love my old boyfriend, too. I'm going to spend time with you. I think I want to spend time with my old boyfriend, too. That's you don't want that.
Right. No. And when it comes to any friend or any relationship, you don't want someone who's double-minded in their priorities. They either love you or they don't. It's hard, and it tugs on your heartstrings, and it causes all kinds of problems when someone's half in, half out. And how much more so than with the Lord for all that he's done for us?
Half in, half out is just out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so he says in verse 11, or verse 10, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. There's real hope here if they're willing to take the route of humility instead of pride, but it sounds like a lot of them are taking the pride route.
These verses in chapter 4, verse 6, 7, and 8, they're just a very practical dynamic that a lot of us need to learn. If we are proud, God is going to resist us. Throughout the Old Testament, maybe we'll talk about a few examples, but that's one of the things that you constantly see. When somebody gets proud, God brings them down. And then the next statement, draw near to God, he'll draw near to you. The last part of verse 7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Sometimes people say, I'm really struggling spiritually. And part of the problem is they're not struggling hard enough. They're not really they're giving in rather than struggling. And if they really were struggling in resisting the devil, they would find all of a sudden the road would get a lot easier because the devil would flee from them and God would be close to them.
You know, as we think about that marriage relationship and how all of that fits together, again, not a direct tie, but I think one that worthy of consideration in the Sermon on the Mount, as we've made various connections, talks about the dangers of adultery and lusting after a woman. And that's the same word that's used here as well in James 4 and verse 2. You lust and do not have. You know, that split allegiance between the world and God, or maybe more directly, strongly, of the devil and God in verse 7. You know, we have broken that alliance with God, or with the devil, and we're told not to go back to that.
Well, you did an interesting thing there. You talked about the world, the conflict between the world and God, or the choice between the world and God, and then you said, or between the devil and God. And what that does is it puts the devil and the world together. Right. God's on one side, and the devil and the world are together on the other side. We talk about worldliness and being friends of the world, and James says here in James chapter 4 and verse 4, whosoever therefore would be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. We think, wow, friend of the world is an enemy with God, but friend of the world is also friend of the devil. The world and the devil go together.
And that connection is made back in chapter 3 and verse 15, that wisdom that does not descend from above. It's earthly, sensual, demonic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can I talk about for a second verse 11 and 12? I realize I do think that there is some, I don't know why I keep asking.
Like, I know, don't ask. Because
we're going to talk about verse 11 and 12. It's one of those couple verses that seemingly you're like, where does this fit into this whole picture that in the context? I do think it fits in this theme of pride and humility we've been talking about, though. So he says, don't criticize one another, brothers and sisters. Anyone who defames or judges a fellow believer defames and judges the law. You are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There's one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and to destroy, but who are you to judge your neighbor? It seems like to me, James is hinting, or really saying, some of you have crossed over in from righteous judgment and trying to help your brother into just critical, arrogant judgment that's not helpful. And you're forgetting you need to be a doer of the law, not a judge of the law. And he brought that up, obviously, back at the end of chapter 1 and in chapter 2, that we're not just out here trying to be judges of the law. We're doers of the law. Now, I think that needs to be balanced with what Jesus said in Matthew 7. I mean, we are going to make judgments. We are going to point out sin in our brother's life. But we need to do that righteously by getting the log out of our own eye if we're going to point out the speck in our brother's. But it seems like there is a real struggle for people, and I'm sure you guys have seen this through the years, where they cross over from trying to righteously and humbly point out a flaw in a brother into just being critical and becoming a judge of the law. And that is it's an easy line to cross after a while. And so I appreciate this admonition, because if we're not careful, we become more critical than we should rather than just helpful and humble. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's in this context, it's not just judging, but it's speaking evil of. It's judging in that harsh and condemning way, not making proper judgments. As you said, Matthew teaches us we must make proper judgments. But this is the judging in the sense of condemning somebody, right?
And condemning someone where the law doesn't, so that I'm, in essence, judging the law because I'm setting myself up as the judge, as the law. And in that sense, I really think what James is saying is corollary to Matthew chapter 7, verse 1 and following. And it's another example of what we've said a number of times. James keeps saying the same things Jesus said, addressing the same mentalities Jesus addressed. So Jesus says in John 7, verse 1, judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge shall you be judged. In other words, when you condemn others by a certain standard, you're setting yourself up to be held to that same standard. And yet what Jesus is addressing is people with a double standard who judge others more harshly than themselves. And so they allow the beam in their own eye and they're critical of the speck in somebody else's eye. They've got a more strict standard for others. And of course, the Pharisees tended to do that. They would judge Jesus' disciples for not holding the traditions of the elders, while in fact the Pharisees themselves would violate God's law in order to keep their own traditions. And so James here then, I think he's talking about that same kind of thing, where you've got people who set themselves up as the judge because they think they get to make the law. And there's only one who is the judge.
Yeah, sorry. No, that is a good compliment. He's emphasizing, just like Jesus did, your need to do the law instead of just see yourself simply as a judge of it. Because it's amazing when you hyper focus on judging others, the amount of sin that you let slip through your own life.
That is true. All right, we come to verse 13 in James 4. Come now, yeah. You say, yeah, you were going to go back to something earlier.
Oh no, I was gonna see if you wanted the group's permission to talk about those verses.
Is it all right if I talk about James 13 and follow?
Yeah, sure.
Wait a minute. How come Joe always gives you a no, but he gave me a yes?
I don't know. We're going to talk about that off the air.
James 4:13. I said 5:13. I'm trying to get into chapter 4, verse 13 here. Come now, you that say today or tomorrow, we will go into this city and spend a year there and trade and get gain. Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. What is your life? For you're a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall both live and do this or that. Now, there are two more verses here that are relevant, and we'll go and see this. But just taking these first three verses, chapter 4, verse 13 through 15, thoughts on that?
So have we jumped ship? I mean, on the surface, it's as if there ought to be a chapter break here. Like, this is a completely different topic, and yet is it?
No, I don't think so. I think there is still a theme here of pride and humility. And because naturally, a rich man is going to really struggle with pride. I know all men do, but especially a rich man. And so I think it's a natural lead-in.
Yeah, it really goes well with chapter 4 and verse 10. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, 4:10 and 4:15. Yeah, I don't think we're changing subjects. We're maybe making a different application, but these principles of wisdom from above versus wisdom from below, or pride and humility, self-seeking versus assisting others, all of those things I think go along all the way through this.
Now, verses 16 and 17. You glory in your vauntings, all such glorying is evil. That I think goes with what we've just said. The idea that I think that I can count on having 30 more years or 20 more years, or that I can count on that this summer is going to come. That's really assuming things that I don't know. But he goes on and he says, to him, therefore, that knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. There's a very simple point James is making here, but people miss the point and get all kind of conscience problems. People read this passage as if it's saying, if there's something good that you could do and you know that it would be good if you do that and you don't do it, then you've sinned. And they get they say, oh, well, I should go visit so-and-so. That'd be a good thing to do. And I didn't do it. So did I sin? Well, why did you not do it? Well, I was taking care of my children. I was taking care of my mother. You were doing good. Yes, there was another good thing you could have done. You didn't do it. But they say, well, James says, to the one who knows to do good and he doesn't do it, it's sin. Have you run into that, people with that kind of? So there's a passage in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17 that I think illustrates the concept, what James is saying here. Come now, I'm sorry, learn to do good. Seek justice, reprove the ruthless, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. He says, learn to do good. The previous verse, he says, cease to do evil. In that context, Isaiah, God speaking through Isaiah, he's not talking about this good thing and that good thing. Yes, do good things, but he's just saying, as a principle, do good. And so in James as well, James chapter 5, verse 17, to him that knows to do good, that's what your life should be about, doing good. Look at your life. Is that what you're doing good, or are you doing evil? That's what it comes down to. It's not if there's some particular thing I could have done today at 2 o'clock and I did something else instead, and the thing I didn't do would have been a good thing. I'm guilty of sin. Am I doing good? That's the question.
I think that's really helpful. I love your connection with Isaiah 1:17. Just this week, I started a study with three young men, and we began in Isaiah 1:17, and we read that. I talked about it for just a couple of minutes, and then I came back with a question. There's five things that are instructed in that. What's the first one? And two of them just really quickly said, do good. I said, no, that's not what it says. And they were like so perplexed by it. And finally, they looked back at the text and read that, learn to do good. And I was like, it's a learned behavior. What we have to do is come to God's word. And again, that goes back to the first chapter of using God's word as that mirror, looking into the law of liberty and so forth. Again, James is a lot like Proverbs, not because you've got dozens of scattered words of wisdom. You know, that's the way that people look at Proverbs. You know, each verse in some places is separate and apart from the verse before and afterward. Not so much with James. It is filled with wisdom, but it is not compartmentalized like Proverbs is.
You know, I used to think that James was incapable of being outlined, that there was no flow through it, that it was, that, like you say, it's kind of like Proverbs. And then a few years ago, I began to realize, no, there is a flow here. There's a theme here. Yeah. Appreciate that observation. Chapter 5?
Yeah. You've been talking about it.
Yeah. Okay. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver are rusted, and their rust shall be for a testimony against you, and shall eat your flesh as fire. You've laid up your treasure in the last days. Behold, the hire of the laborers who mowed your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud. In other words, you don't pay the people that you hire. You don't give them their paycheck. That cries out, and the cries of them that reaped have entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, which is Lord of hosts, which is an Old Testament expression. And again, we've said repeatedly, James is a very Jewish book. But also, just this language here in chapter 5, verse 1 and following, talking about your gold and your silver rusted, so reminiscent of Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount. Let's get two more verses. You've lived delicately on the earth and taken your pleasure. You've nourished your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you've killed the righteous one. He doth not resist you. Again, this is a paragraph that, and we mentioned this a little bit earlier, it seems that James is not just addressing Christians here, Jewish Christians, that he is, this is, he's, whether he's expecting that people, Jews of all religious stripes will pick up this letter and read it, or whether he is addressing them kind of in the third person. He's addressing them in the second person, but is he addressing them in a letter to Christians, or is he expecting that they will read this? It does seem he's addressing the general Jewish population.
This just occurred to me. Again, chapter breaks just mess with your brain, but in 4:17, it is sin to know the good and yet not do it.
Mm-hmm.
If he's addressing more than just the Jewish audience, that would make sense. You don't need Torah. You don't need the law to know, hey, if someone worked for you and you agreed upon a certain price, that you should pay them. That's the right and good thing to do. That is a sin for them to do this. Maybe that's not exactly the idea there, but I do think that maybe that connects.
Yeah, I think there's a connection there. As well, you know, there are plenty of places in Scripture, and we may have mentioned this last week. I know I talked about it in another study, there's a number of places where the Lord, through various writers, are speaking to other people who will likely never see what is written. Yeah. We have that in Isaiah 13 through 28. I'm thinking about the book of Obadiah. Did Edom even know what was being said by Obadiah? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But the benefit is when the Israelites would read that and know what God is thinking about it. I think that might be the case here as well. And so speaking to the broader audience, maybe some of the Jews are going to hear that. Whether they do or whether they don't, the Christians are going to take heed and learn how to respond either as the laborer or as the rich man.
Well put. That's kind of what I was trying to say, and I didn't get it said very well. But yeah, well put, well illustrated.
It is also interesting that this is something from the law of Moses in Deuteronomy 24, 14 and 15. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land within your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages and not let the sun go down on it. For he is poor and has set his heart on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord and it be a sin to you. And so I think, again, tying 4:17, it be a sin to you at the end of that. That's what Moses is tying together, this withholding of wages. And, you know, if you don't do the right thing, that's going to be a sin. God's going to hold you accountable to that.
Good. All right. Anything else there in those first six verses?
I'll let you go ahead. Yeah.
No, what's your thought?
Well, my thought is in the next text.
Then take us to it.
So verse 7 is, again, I'm reading from the New King James. Is it the same in the New American Standard? Therefore, be patient. Is your old translation the same there? Therefore?
Yeah.
This is a conclusionary term to what we're just talking about. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Maybe just pause there. We can keep going. But it seems like maybe there's a contrast between verse 1, you rich need to weep and wail, or weep and howl, and verse 7, brethren, you just need to hold on. You be patient. God's coming to your rescue.
I think that's right.
Go ahead.
Now, I also want to, again, just keep emphasizing how Jewish this letter is. Even the agricultural reference here at the end of verse 7, the early and latter rain, that's something you see in the prophets. Joel chapter 2 and verse 23, and it's a picture of the blessings of God that an agricultural people would appreciate.
Right. Yeah, very much so. And so even as brethren, we might be tempted to grumble against each other. You know, maybe somebody is withholding from us. Maybe somebody is mistreating us. We need to make sure that we are putting our trust in the Lord instead of, you know, maybe reaching out. I'm kind of imagining, a number of scenarios, but somebody hurts you, so you go and hurt somebody else. You're kind of developing that mentality. Don't grumble against one another.
And thinking about the judge standing at the door, God hearing that, you know, what, listening in, hearing the things that you're saying about each other. And it reminds me of chapter 3, whenever he's giving reminders about the tongue, and he says, with the tongue we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in God's likeness. Man, we need to think more carefully about how we talk about our brethren, no matter the circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so where are we? Ready for verse 10?
Yep.
Take, brethren, for an example of suffering and of patience, the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord, Behold, we call them blessed that endured. You've heard of the patience, or you could say the steadfastness or the endurance of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, how that the Lord is full of pity and merciful.
So, you know, it'd be really neat if we can, as we're getting to the close to the end of the book of James, if there were only another comparison to make with the Sermon on the Mount here about the prophets of old suffering, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the end of the Beatitudes, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's pretty cool to think about how many of them there are. I did not appreciate so many of them until we started going through this. So I appreciate you all helping me to see some that I had missed. But this looks a lot like Proverbs 5 or Matthew 5, verses 10 through 12.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the point there of trusting in God.
Mm-hmm. I'll read it. Matthew 5, 10 through 12. Blessed are those that have been persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall reproach you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets that were before you. And then, since we're making these connections between James and Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount and the Jewish nature of all of this, James 5:12, but above all things, my brethren, swear not neither by heaven nor by the earth nor by any other oath, but let your yea be yea and your nay nay, that you fall not under judgment. I think we want to do a couple of things here. We want to see the connection between what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount and also what he says in Matthew chapter 23. And then we want to talk about, practically speaking, what does this mean for us? Can we swear or not? And so let's talk a little bit about that. And we've got 3 minutes to do all that.
So obviously, let's just talk about the greater principle, right? I mean, Jesus is clearly talking about Christians ought not be of this business where when we say, I swear or I swear on these different things, depending on what we swear on or how we say it or the context in which we do it, there might be a 15% chance you're telling the truth all the way to an 80% chance. There shouldn't be a game with our speech.
And that's what Jesus clearly is talking about in Matthew 23 when he says they swear by the temple or the gold of the temple. If they swear by the temple, they don't think they're obligated. But if they swear by the gold of the temple, they're obligated. And that's good.
Yes. And so James is saying the same. I mean, he just says swear by either by heaven or by earth. It doesn't matter. You don't need to do that. Your yes should be yes and your no should be no. So that's the greater principle. So with that being said, I guess that gets to your latter point. I don't think he's saying here you cannot take an oath. I think the greater principle is, are you defined by having to swear and say those certain things in order to convince people that you're honestly telling the truth? If that's your character, then you need to repent of that and change. So I wouldn't be opposed to saying you could take some kind of oath in certain contexts.
In fact, isn't this the same word that's used of God swearing in Hebrews 6, that God swore or gave an oath?
By nothing greater.
Yeah, he could swear by no one greater. He swore by himself. But I think that's the same point. You know, we're not trying to say, okay, now I'm telling the truth now. Really, I am. It needs to be either yes, yes, or no, no. People need to be able to trust us.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, let's see. I flipped away from James. Let me get back to it here. That's probably a good place for us to stop today. Yep. And I think maybe let's get one more week. We've got some interesting things that will actually require some time in the next few verses there. You want to do that next week?
Maybe we got Job that we kind of skipped there. We got Elijah, and then maybe we can just talk about the men and women of the book that are used as illustrations in James.
That'd be good. And there's one point back in chapter one I'd like to go back to also. So we'll spend one more week on the book of James. Thank you. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. Let us know if you have comments about what we talk about. Lord willing, we will. Yes, Joe, what?
I thought Chase was in charge today.
Lord willing, we will see you next week.